to the Red Seat Podcast. This is your host, Jake Severin. Today I'm joined not only by Matt Corey of BP Boston, but we have special guest Alex Speer of the Boston Globe joining us today. Guys, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, folks.
Appreciate it.
So today we have a lot to talk about, and since we do have a special guest on, we are lucky that we're going to be able to get all of our questions answered, hopefully. So the first thing we want to do is kind of assess where the Red Sox are right now, and I know, Matt, that's been a big concern of yours. So, Matt, why don't you start us off today?
Okay. So, Alex, we saw what happened this weekend. It at times was exciting, but I think the end result was not pretty. The Red Sox lost 3 games to the Yankees in Yankee Stadium. And so I wanted to start off by looking at sort of big picture. Where are the Red Sox right now as a team, as it relates to the American League, as it relates to their, their sort of future this season?
Well, so I think that's the funny thing, right? Like, the tendency is to look at any given moment and try to connect it to those broader picture issues. Whereas, really the smaller picture sometimes is just that. Like, sometimes it's not a part of a larger whole. And so it strikes me that, teams over the course of a season, this is a Red Sox team that is somewhat inconsistent. That at times looks kind of flat and looks kind of short on talent, and that other times it looks pretty brilliant. I don't think that either of those assessments is inaccurate. I don't think that either of them, that a given moment in time connects them to who they are in the bigger picture. Like, really what we know is that their ceiling is very high. Their baseline is pretty good. They aren't a team that looks like it gets, dives into troughs that aren't insurmountable. They're competitive, at least. So at any rate, I think that where they are right now is they're obviously in terrific position to make it to the postseason based on the fact that they're 3.5 up. They're in terrific position to win the American League East. They're a team that right now doesn't have any of its star level performers performing at star levels. So essentially what we know is if they don't have their stars performing as stars, they're probably going to be in some trouble. They're probably going to be in some trouble at a future point, chiefly the postseason. If they do have their stars performing at star levels, they'll look very different than they did over the course of this weekend.
So, Alex, as a follow-up to that question, I want to go off the stars here, because you recently wrote about Bogarts and Betts struggling quite a bit here, especially in the second half, where Betts has been sort of expanding the zone and being a very different hitter than we saw from him last year. Also, Chris Sale has been scuffling a little bit. Can you assess the performance of those three players lately and kind of give us your sense of how much we should be worrying about those guys?
Bogarts is an interesting one because he's been trying to work through an injury, through injuries over the course of the entire season that affect fundamentally who he is as a hitter. It struck me that we underappreciate how good Dustin Pedroia has been throughout his career, because hand injuries are ruinous, right? Hand and wrist injuries, those are the money makers with hitters. And usually if you have hand or wrist injuries, you are in deep trouble in terms of sustaining your traditional levels of production. Xander Bogaerts has spent most of this year dealing with hand and wrist injuries. He, early in the year, had a wrist injury that was incurred, I think, on a slide. And he spent about a month not being able to swing with, at that time, his lower hand. But he still managed to perform pretty well through that period, but just not hitting for any power. Then he got healthy for about a month. He was performing really well. In early July, you could look at the landscape of American League shortstops and say he was one of the best of them. And then he got smoked on the right hand by a pitch, and he wasn't able to swing for a long time with his top hand. So you've seen Xander Bogaerts for about half of this year swinging with one hand. And when he was swinging with two hands, his mechanics had been all messed up. So I have no idea whether or not Bogaerts is going to be able to restore more kind of traditional production patterns, or what we consider to be a very reasonable expectation of his production going forward. He's been among the least productive hitters in the American League since getting hit on the hand by that pitch. And I don't think that's a coincidence. He mentioned to me last week that he thought, he was looking forward to, he was hoping that the Red Sox would clinch early so that they would be in good position to give them, to give him a few days off and maybe get him back to health. Obviously, they didn't wait that long to try to give him those few days, based on what they saw as kind of the severity of his approach struggles. So it's going to be interesting because he's shown flashes of being good. He was in parts of August, he was hitting the ball, you know, very well, starting to pull the ball a little bit more, which is a sign of the health of his hands. But, you know, I honestly have no idea what to expect from him going forward, based on whether I don't know how long he needs off in order for his hands to get to a healthy point and for his mechanics to get locked back in. He can be very good, or he can be kind of a frankly, a bit of a detriment to the lineup, at least at the plate. He's still a very good, you know, base runner, an impact base runner, even when he's dealing with those offensive struggles. Betts has gotten away from the approach that made him really good last year. He became so accustomed to looking away, 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 away for pitches that he stopped being able to turn on balls and hitting them hard to left field. He took a lot of pitches. He took a lot of pitches on the inner half of the plate in a way that hindered his production pretty considerably. That's his wheelhouse. So he's not attacking the pitches where he can do the most damage, and instead he's kind of trying to respond to what the pitchers are doing instead of what he's doing. He's working on it. He's aware of it. You know, the Red Sox hitting coaches are aware of it. But it can be harder to implement what you identify than just to identify it. I did think that yesterday, that ball he pulled down the third baseline, you might recall Frazier making a terrible throw on it after a diving stop, was actually a kind of good sign for him against Severino. And then as for Chris Sale, again, we're in somewhat uncharted territory with regards to the fact that this is someone who has shown a bit of fatigue over the latter part of the season in the past, whose results have been diminished, or at least more consistent after the All-Star break than before it. We're seeing some of that now, and we're also seeing a guy who, against the Yankees, I do think that there's something to be said for the idea that familiarity against Chris Sale kind of works against him, because the tremendous deception that his delivery creates by virtue of its novelty, the strangeness of the release point, that oddity of the crossover delivery, the crossfire delivery, that diminishes over time, which I think plays into why Cleveland hits him so well, why Kansas City and Minnesota hit him so well as teams that are familiar with him in the AL Central. And, you know, I think that maybe some of that is working against him with the Yankees as well at this point.
Wow. That's dangerous if you're talking about a pitcher who, you know, if you go long in a 7-game series, you'd be throwing 3 times against the same team in a short period of time.
Possibly, although at the same time, you know, he still has stuff that can be completely overwhelming depending on how that workload is spaced out and how strong he's feeling. I think that, you know, we've seen Chris Sale be dominant against another lineup in back-to-back starts, for instance. I don't know that we've seen it in 3 straight starts just because of the rarity of that occurring him. But, you know, I think that he's, you know, regardless of familiarity, like, his stuff is still crazy good, right? And so he can still shut down, you know, an opposing lineup at any given time. But I think that with any pitcher, the likelihood of their being dominant over the course of 3 appearances in 1 series is less than it is over the course of 2 of them, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I think it's really easy, and you kind of made this point before, how it's you can get caught up in a you know, for better or worse, a small sample of information of you know, team performance, and end up with, you know, overreacting one way or the other. You know, the famous saying about how teams are always better than they are when they're losing and worse than they are when they're winning. That seems to really apply to the Red Sox, who do a very good job of you know, looking incredibly good when they win and incredibly bad when they lose.
Yeah, well, we like to look at things through a magnifying glass rather than a telescope, right?
Yes, especially Red Sox Nation loves that, or hates it. I don't know.
Self-loathing, then. I
yeah,
suppose.
Well, Alex, one of the things that you recently magnified in an article was the inability that the Red Sox have to hit lefties, especially as of late. And, you know, being sort of obsessed with the Red Sox like I am, what I did after that was I went and examined just how many left-handed pitchers all of the current playoff teams have in both leagues. And I realized that you kind of undertook the same exercise at the end of your article as well. But one of the things that I came away
with... I could have saved you time.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
I didn't get to the NL.
So I was looking at the NL, and the only team out there that actually does have a whole slew of left-handed starters is predictably the Dodgers, who are far and away the best team in all of baseball. But really, outside of that, there weren't too many teams that had a plethora of lefties that might worry the Red Sox. And especially looking at the American League, it doesn't seem to be that troubling. How worried about this should we be as Red Sox fans here about the ability for the team to actually square up lefties come playoff time?
I would throw the Cubs in there just by virtue of Lester and Quintana. That would be a pretty formidable, you know, potentially up to 7 starts that they would be getting out of lefties.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I think that the American League landscape is kind of light on lefties, save for the Yankees can run at least, you know, 2, maybe 3 out there if they wanted to. Granted, it would mean going with, you know, it would mean going with like Garcia and Montgomery in addition to Sabathia over maybe a Sonny Gray, which seems unlikely. But I think you're right. Most of the teams in the American League feature 0 or 1 left-handed pitchers. It would be really interesting in a short series to see whether or not Cleveland would line up like Ryan Merritt as one of their starters instead of like Trevor Bauer or, you know, depending on how his health is, Salazar. But I think that for the Red Sox, they're to a degree fortunate that teams seem to be predominantly right-handed. You know, Dallas Keuchel looms as an obvious impressive left-hander in the American League. But the lion's share of good starting pitchers are right-handed pitchers in the American League. Granted, the Red Sox have made pretty mediocre left-handed pitchers look quite good in recent months. So it'll be interesting to monitor. But yeah, I think that it would be surprising if that was ultimately like their proverbial Achilles heel.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting thing to monitor. It's kind of funny when I looked at it, and I was thinking of some of the left-handed relievers that they've hit really well too, Aroldis Chapman, and then when they had success against Andrew Miller right before he went down, it was kind of interesting just how bad they've struggled against the starters. When would they have succeeded against some of the best relievers that come from that side?
Yeah, I think that part of it is based on the fact that this is a team that, you know, that isn't intimidated by fastball velocity, right? Like their bat to ball skills play really well against high velocity pitchers of both, you know, of both handedness, right? So with Chapman especially, when you're able to eliminate the slider if it's not very effective, they aren't that intimidated by 101 to 103, which is strange as it is to say. Whereas I do think that. I do think that particularly with some of their younger guys, it's a little bit more difficult when you're dealing with, you know, 3 and 4 pitch mixes from kind of carving the strike zone left-handed pitchers rather than just guys who are trying to win with power.
So then I suppose that the proverbial nightmare for the Red Sox would be a team that featured a rotation of lefties who could all spin the ball all different ways.
I think that's a lot of teams' nightmares, but I think that, you know, I would say that seems accurate based on what we've seen this year to date. In no small part because the Red Sox have had the right-handers who should be hitting lefties have been woeful against them.
So weird. Do you think that's the kind of thing that the Red Sox need to correct as a flaw in their roster, or is that just sort of a kind of odd statistical, you know, blip that, you know, I mean, they've got, you know, Betts and Bogarts and on, like they ought to be able to hit left-handed pitching to some extent, right?
Yeah, well, they also depended a lot on, you know, on, well, so there are 3 fall-offs that are just massive for them this year in terms of production against lefties. One of them is Chris Young, who's who entering the weekend was down about 400 points against lefties in OPS. One of them is Sandy Leon, who was down about 400 points from last year. We forget that he was the world's greatest right-handed hitter last year. And then Hanley Ramirez was down about 300 points. Those are massive drop-offs. Leon, I think that represents a coming down to earth. But I think that the extremity of in terms of bigger picture issues this year, I don't know whether or not there's anything that explains Chris Young's drop off. I don't know whether or not there's time for him to correct it. I imagine that by next year they won't have a fourth outfielder who's the odds are their fourth outfielder, likely to be a right-handed hitter, is not going to have a sub 600 OPS against lefties. But in terms of the rest of this year, I think you've seen flashes recently of Hanley Ramirez having impactful at-bats. I think that their hope would be that, in a focused playoff situation, that, he would kind of elevate his game. He has been at times a pretty impressive September and postseason hitter, but it remains to be seen. I think that it's a head scratcher, frankly. It's a head scratcher.
I think the media might need to do their duty and remind him before the playoffs that he is not doing what he's supposed to against left-handed pitchers, because that seemed to work pretty well for him for that week or two when he was reminded of that in the middle of the year.
I think the Red Sox kind of obliquely tried to remind him of that by dropping him to seventh in the lineup.
that might have clued him in. I'm going to move on to David Price, if I may. So Price has been, not what the Red Sox wanted since they, to quote Joe Girardi, since they signed him two off seasons ago.
The premise is getting off to a rocky start. I think that last year was pretty close to what they, it was pretty much what they wanted.
You think so? Okay. Fair. I would say that they probably wanted a little more in terms of production. I can see the argument in terms of overall innings, and obviously the team was very successful up until those last three games. So, I guess it depends on how you grade these things out. But I think that there is certainly an argument to be made that Price could have this sort of season where he misses a lot of time. And still looks good for the most part when he comes back on the mound, but misses so much time that that hurts the team. But then, he comes back in the playoffs and pitches well, and that's a successful season. I wonder about what he's able to contribute, to the team this year. Do you think he'll make it back for the playoffs? And maybe more interestingly, how does he fit into the Red Sox, going forward?
Great question.
I said, despite the rocky start.
Yeah. Well, despite the rocky start, right. I think that ultimately, the question of what David Price is and can contribute in 2017 is a fascinating one without an answer right now. No idea whether or not he comes back. I think that, it's trending in that direction, where you would think that he would be a potential contributor. Maybe he's activated by the last week or so of the season. Maybe a little bit before that, but probably not much. I have a really hard time thinking that he could be stretched out to be a starter in the postseason. It's hard to imagine that they would be able to build up his innings load to think that they have any degree of reliability. Now, during the postseason, it's possible that, maybe you slot him in as a multi-inning reliever and he shows you something that permits him to be kind of stretched out as almost a piggyback starter, and then he can be in a later round starting situation. But honestly, that's all speculation. The Red Sox are barely bothering to go through that exercise themselves because they just want to see whether or not he can, he can go through bullpen sessions and continue building up progressively. And then they'll figure out if he can start facing batters in a simulated game situation to prepare himself for a return to the mound. But, you know, I think that ultimately the calendar is going to force a question of whether or not his contributions would be, you know, whether or not he can contribute out of the bullpen. I find it hard to imagine that he would be in a position to contribute as a starter, but I've been surprised before.
Yeah, no, I think the idea of him in the bullpen is very interesting. I mean, considering, you know, what we've seen from the Red Sox bullpen, I think it could be fairly argued that, you know, the Red Sox bullpen has been, you know, over their heads a little bit. You know, Kimbrel obviously has been fantastic, and his performance lines up with his peripheral numbers, but a lot of the other relievers, maybe save Addison Reed, haven't, don't look as good when you consider their peripherals, especially, you know, guys like Kelly. So I think there could be a spot for a David Price in the bullpen, you know, in the seventh or maybe not the eighth inning, but depending on how much workload Reed has had and how he's looked and what the matchup is, you know, I guess lefty versus righty could play a role there too.
Especially consider the type of pitcher that Price was before the injury, right? He was very fastball cutter heavy. He was coming in as a power reliever for, you know, six to seven innings at a time during his good run. So it doesn't take too much imagination to imagine how he could translate as a contributor.
Yeah,
and he certainly doesn't have the postseason negative track record as a reliever that he does as a starter too, which is kind of a funny note because Tampa Bay used him that way, I believe, early on in his career, and he was really effective as a reliever in the playoffs.
I think that there are a lot of members of a 2008 Red Sox team that thought it was a championship caliber team that would agree with you.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I kind of want to piggyback off this, thinking about the playoffs and the way that the team might start aligning things and shift the focus to Doug Fister, a guy who in the second half has had a 3.63 ERA. On the road, he's been a 3.49 ERA pitcher. He's been greatly improved, it seems, by shifting across the rubber to the first base side. And has been really effective. So I guess my question to you, Alex, is this a guy that we need to start thinking about as part of the postseason rotation instead of a guy like Eduardo Rodriguez, who has struggled, has an ERA over 5 in the second half? Eduardo seems to be someone who could be a very helpful lefty out of the bullpen, too, if he did move in that direction. How do you see the playoff rotation sort of shaking out if things were to end today? And what do you think about the change that Fister has made?
I think that in part you can make the decision based on how well both of those guys are throwing at the very, very end of the season and on the splits and the swing paths and all of that stuff that you're facing. So I think that Fister is clearly a candidate. He has pitched his way into being a clear candidate for the postseason rotation. You would assume in a vacuum he would be right now positioned ahead of Rodriguez, but there are circumstances that could sway that. In terms of the switch that he's made, I think that it's a subtle thing, but I think that there's a larger story that it's part of, which is that I think the Red Sox have done a really good job of maximizing the value of their pitchers this year, really dating back to last year. I think that you mentioned the overperformance, quote unquote, of the bullpen. Well, I think that they've done a really good job of finding ways both of picking the right leverage spots and of tweaking pitch mixes and of making some small mechanical tweaks with a lot of guys in order to bring out a considerable amount of effectiveness to them. And I think that's a pretty significant development for the Red Sox, not just now, but going forward, that they seem to be an organization that's doing a really good job of working with their pitchers to get them to be effective. And I think getting Fister has found money. Fister has outpitched Sonny Gray since the July 31st trade, since the Yankees acquired Gray, right? And Fister cost them nothing but cash. That tells you how significant it is to be able to maximize the value of pitchers.
And who gets credit for that, Alex? Is that Carl Willis? Or, I mean, who's part of that team that helps them achieve that?
I think that the pitching infrastructure top to bottom is pretty impressive, is pretty good right now. I think some of that goes to Willis, who we should, you know, there's a decent chance that Carl Willis is right now serving as the pitching coach for his fourth Cy Young pitcher right now, or fifth, right? That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Beyond that, Dana Lavangie, I believe, the bullpen coach, who's really, really sharp. was the one who suggested the move on the rubber. I think that he's often very keyed into pitcher's footwork on the rubber and what looks like it may or may not work a little bit better. Brian Bannister, the director of pitching analytics, is really sharp on that. He too is a big proponent of kind of finding the right rubber position for pitchers in order to get them to maximize their effectiveness. And, you know, John Farrell has some pitching history there as well. So I think that right now they have a pretty good pitching infrastructure. You know, there are probably a lot of people who deserve credit for that, and some of them aren't even mentioned.
Yeah, it's certainly been really nice to see the work that they've been able to do with those units. I want to shift the focus now a little bit to one of the most interesting articles that I think I've seen recently, and it was something that you wrote about the team potentially. Yay. potentially fielding a all homegrown lineup next year, depending on what happens with first base. You look around the diamond, and first base could potentially be filled by possibly Sam Travis if he gets things going. Probably not next year, though, at this point. Or Michael Chavis, who's going to be switching to first base part-time during the Arizona Fall League to see what
that looks like. Right, playing both corners in the AFL. But right. Yeah,
so I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on Chavis making that move to first base, as well as Sam Travis's readiness, you think. I mean, I know that the power really hasn't been there. And then kind of what your best guess is to what the Sox will do with the first base situation, because Moreland has been an unbelievably valuable part of this team this year. He's been an excellent pinch hitter, could be in line for another gold glove this year. Lots of things that Mitch Moreland has done make him seem to be worthy of re-upping him. But, you know, they have other options. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
I guess I'll start with Travis. I don't think that Travis is ready to be an everyday guy at the start of next year, in part because the splits have been significant. He's been really good against lefties, not so much against righties, neither the big leagues or in AAA. And, you know, his defense has made progress, but it's not an elite level. The power still hasn't come. There's further development for Sam Travis to, you know, for Sam Travis to undergo. And I think that, you know, the Red Sox could certainly consider him as a right-handed platoon guy next year. But I think that there's a pretty good case to be made that he opens the year again next year in Pawtucket after a fully healthy offseason. Let's not forget that last season was just a rehab offseason for him to try to see what kind of hitter he can become. But he's clearly part of the big league depth equation, as witnessed by the fact that he's up right now. So Michael Chavis is further away, obviously, just spent the second half of the season in Portland. But there aren't any vacancies for him to get to the big leagues right now, except at first base. So I think that it's noteworthy and sensible that he's getting time at first base. I guess that the other thing you could do is explore him as in left field and maybe as that kind of future Chris Young-ish consideration with a little bit more positional versatility, getting infield, outfield. But Chavis probably is at least of, you know, best case scenario for him is like very end of 2018. Travis would be, to me, like your best timetable for him is maybe after a couple of months in Pawtucket next year, you could consider him for an everyday role if the need arose. So in the shorter term, I think that you're looking at the Red Sox likely diving back into the market and looking for yet another short-term bat. Maybe that's Moreland if 1 year is once again his market. It's hard for me to see them making a monster, pursuing a monster deal with a guy like Eric Hosmer, there are a lot of things about Hosmer that I like, and I think that his swing would play terrifically well at Fenway, but it just seems like that profile of left-handed hitting first baseman who's a good defensive player is kind of replicable for less money than Hosmer is going to be seeking, and certainly fewer years at a time when the Red Sox seem to have some longer term possibilities for the position in their organization.
I wonder if it's possible to get Sam Travis to exchange contact information with Justin Turner and maybe rework some of that swing path and make it more of an uppercut swing. What do you think about that?
It's something that certainly you wonder about, because it's not just the uppercut swing. It's also that, you know, most of the balls that he drives are to right center. And so you do wonder about, you know, about a guy like that with the hands like that, seeking out a contact point that's a little bit further in front of the plate where he can start to pull the ball and really lean into it. It's a really interesting philosophical question that the Red Sox have been wrestling with, I think, because they haven't really wanted guys to rework their swings fundamentally. They have been more interested in seeing guys solidify their hit tool above seeking out power. But, you know, in this day and age, you wonder whether or not that remains the right approach with someone like Travis, who is at a position that kind of demands power.
I was going to switch topics a little bit. I wanted to talk to you about power, but before I do that, I want to. So it's interesting when you can look at a move that was made sort of in totality. Like, we love to judge things the moment they happen, but usually, or always, you don't have enough information to really make an accurate assessment about something. In this particular case, the Red Sox releasing Pablo Sandoval kind of closes the book on that, and we can look back at that move, that signing, and, you know, really assess it. And I'm curious, Alex, because there's a lot of, Sandoval hate, I guess, certainly on Twitter. There's a lot of all types of hate on Twitter. obviously the fan base really turned on Sandoval. Looking back at that, 2014 offseason, it was giving him that contract, was bringing him in, was it really a bad move? Like, is that, or was that something that just, maybe the process was good and the outcome just was bad?
Maybe a little of both. I guess the big question has always been, should the Red Sox have been able to get involved in the Josh Donaldson sweepstakes? Because they've said consistently that they never really had that chance, and that they would have been pretty interested. Although I guess that the likelihood is that the A's would have insisted on like Bogarts in a Donaldson deal. So it would have been up in the air whether or not the Red Sox would have entertained that as kind of the headliner of a package. Maybe Bogarts was coming off of a down year. Let's assume that that Donaldson was never made available to the Red Sox. Then looking back, they had a desperate need at third base. It looked really bad at the position for the long haul, because Garen Cecchini had kind of disappeared. Will Middlebrooks had ceased to be a reliable option at the position. And, so I guess, if you don't want Brock Holt to be your everyday third baseman, then you had two options. You had Pablo Sandoval or Chase Headley. The fact that the market was where it was on Sandoval, there were three teams that were involved at basically the same dollars, suggested the Red Sox weren't off, I don't think, in terms of his market value. In terms of evaluating how he would transition to Boston how all of the kind of off-field considerations of managing his preparations for a year would translate. I think that represented an unknown that blew up in their faces, not because – but I think that that's an almost impossible one to predict. I think that, so do I think that it was a – obviously it ended up being a really bad contract. Yeah. Was it ill-advised? I'm not sure that it was – I'm not sure that it was, given what the alternatives were and the fact that kind of the status quo looked pretty unacceptable.
Yeah, I think that is really solid analysis. I mean, unless you want to make the argument that, that you sign Headley instead, and, obviously that contract has turned out a little bit better. Headley is still on the team that signed him and did a little bit of damage to the Red Sox this weekend, as a matter of fact. I'm in agreement with you on that. It's unfortunate. I get this at some point in the future, I wonder if someone will look back at, you know, the Ben Sherrington regime and, you know, do a deep dive into it, because there are so many interesting moves that were made, and so many that turned out, you know, so polarizing, some incredibly well and some incredibly badly. And I'm of the opinion, and you would know certainly better than me, that, you know, Charrington was a solid general manager, and you know, is a smart guy who had good processes, and in some cases just got massively unlucky.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think that there was solid basis for nearly every decision that he made. Obviously, you know, on a number of instances, his generally conservative approach to dealing prospects, and his view that, you know, he had a view that I really don't know which of these guys is going to turn into, you know, the impact one. So let's kind of keep quantity in order to yield quality. There was a lot to that. I think that there's also a very different, you know, there's also a very different model for success, but it is a successful model, with Dave Dombrowski identifying these are the couple guys we believe will be successful, and let's steal the rest. It's really fascinating. I think that Ben positioned them to be in a very good spot for a number of years. I think that, you know, Dave Dombrowski is the beneficiary thereof, and the current Red Sox success reflects a lot of what Ben Charrington built. I think that he had a strikingly unlucky run, I think, with a number of decisions, and even just the timing of decisions that worked out. You know, like Rick Porcello ended up being a really good move for them, just not while Ben Charrington was the general manager.
Right.
I think that he, you know, I think that he kind of flipped a bunch of tails in a row. And it's, of course, that came after he had a pretty extraordinary run of flipping a bunch of heads in a row. So that was in 2013, obviously. So I think that it's kind of like where the conversation began, right? Like, you know, we tend to look at things. We tend to look at things through that magnifying glass, the most immediate stuff through a magnifying glass, while forgetting the stuff on the periphery. But ultimately, all of that is part of Ben Charrington's track record. And it's kind of stupid of people to say that, like, you know, he was just lucky in 2013, and that the 2014, 2015 offseason was, you know, kind of the more accurate assessment of who he is. It's all part of who he is.
Right. So Alex, you probably know the answer to this, but I pulled up the Red Sox player or team page, and I've sorted it by slugging percentage. If you ignore Chase Darnot, who in one plate appearance has a 1,000 slugging percentage, and Chris Sale,
what a magical plate appearance it was.
Yeah. And Chris Sale, who has a 667 slugging percentage in three plate appearances. Do you know who the player, and I think this is just Red Sox at bats, Red Sox plate appearances. Do you know who the player is who has the highest slugging percentage on the Red Sox, and what that is, or what generally that is?
I'll go with Eduardo Nunez for 550.
Yeah, that's pretty heads up. 545.
Nice.
Eduardo Nunez, very good. Yeah. Jake, how many Red Sox have slugging percentages over 500?
I would bet two.
That is correct also. Gosh, you guys are good. The other one is Devers at 511. After that, the highest is Mitch Moreland at 444, and then Benintendi at 441. So it drops off pretty significantly. You've got a lot of guys over 400, not really very many guys over 450. And it's particularly odd because, well, for two reasons. One is this Red Sox team led baseball in runs scored last year. They didn't have a problem hitting home runs. Obviously, they lost David Ortiz, but still, the talent, you know, is mostly still there. And the other thing is, you know, the league context, which is that there are more home runs hit this year than I think ever before. So, you know, home runs are by definition easier to hit this year than ever before. And yet here we are with a team that doesn't hit home runs, doesn't hit for power. That has led to lots of fun online speculation about Giancarlo Stanton as a fun, certainly, player to watch, but one with obvious warts in terms of his contract and, you know, his injury history. I wanted to ask you, Alex, and I understand we're getting up against it, so maybe we'll let you go soon after.
Yeah.
but I wanted to ask
Labor Day, man. Labor Day.
Yeah, you're laboring right now. I wanted to ask you about power on this team. Do they need to add a big bat like Stanton, or is this just a, you know, again, a one-year sort of blip as far as power goes on this team?
I think that the answer, again, I would get to the answer is probably both. I think that there are a number of guys who have underperformed their power. I think that going forward, you can probably expect more power from, you know, just like chip away at the roster and like throw in an extra, let's say, 3 home runs next year for Betts and 5 more home runs from a, you know, from a developing Benintendi, and let's say 7 more home runs from Bogarts when he has 2 hands. And you all of a sudden, you know, even Pedroia, like a couple more from him, because he was dealing with the hand injuries early in the season that wiped out his power up until he had that surge that preceded the knee stuff. So I think that you can be looking rather reasonably at a middle of the pack power team rather than one that's on the very bottom of the spectrum. But I still think that they could probably use, you know, I still think that they probably could use that guy who is an absolute monster in the middle of the order. I think that in the same way that Dave Dombrowski came on in 2015 and said, yeah, we need an ace. Like, I think that it's just kind of like sometimes you don't want to overcomplicate things. Yeah, they need a guy who can crush the ball, right? And I think that, you know, whether or not that's Stanton or not, I'm not sure whether or not that's the answer, but I would be awfully surprised if they didn't find someone who represented a little bit more of a reliable, you know, middle-of-the-order source power for them next year.
Jake, I'll give you the last one, and then – we'll let poor Alex get back to his family.
Sure. Yeah. So, Alex, one of my favorite exercises is to pour over the 40-man roster exhaustively and try and determine who they are going to protect. And they've got some interesting decisions coming up. Right now, everybody is up with the team that's on the 40-man, aside from Price, Ben Taylor, Kyle Martin, Henry Owens, and Brian Johnson. I guess my thing is, I want to ask you, with guys coming off the DL at some point, you know, after the World Series, coming off the 60-man that they're going to have to protect, and with choices needing to be made on guys like Rutledge, Taylor, Martin, how are they going to protect guys like Jalen Beeks, Bryce Brentz, activate Carson Smith? Who do you see as the odd men out on this roster? And is it a precursor that they brought up, say, Austin Maddox and left Ben Taylor down in Pawtucket, or Kyle Martin down in Pawtucket? Like, who should we be expecting to be protected and not protected when the dust settles here?
I am afraid that I haven't gone through the exercise as rigorously as you have to this point. It is one that I need to go through, you know, in the future. But the obvious vulnerabilities are, you know, begin with the guys who you cite who aren't up in the big leagues, whether that is, you know, whether that is a guy like Kyle Martin, like a Ben Taylor, who are kind of a replaceable commodity when it comes to right-handed middle relief options. Even when they have some options remaining, they aren't 3. I think that Beeks represents a far more rare commodity. And then, you know, Henry Owens, there's a big question there about whether or not they would keep him on the 40-man going forward as a kind of lottery ticket. I think that, you know, it'll be interesting to see. Some of these guys are going to get traded, probably, right? Like, I think it'll be interesting to monitor where Brian Johnson is, because he's out of options after this year. So is Blake Swihart. So either of those guys immediately become become trade candidates, if you think that there's a greater chance of leveraging value from them and you aren't 100% certain of their roles going forward. Utility, they're overstocked, so that would make Josh Rutledge kind of vulnerable. Let's not forget that Marco Hernandez was on the DL. They're probably going to have to trade away someone from the utility, from the left-handed utility pool of Marco Hernandez, Brock Holt, Tsui Lin, in order to clear roster space. Yeah, I think that that's kind of a – and I think – right, I think that Josh Rutledge would be vulnerable as well. So that's kind of – you know, that those are a few names that I would put out there.
All right. And then last one here. For the AFL roster, do you feel like there's any surprises?
You know, seeing two starting pitchers qualifies as a surprise, sure. I think that seeing Brian Johnson – and Henry Owens makes all the sense in the world. He needs more time to work with that new delivery. Brian Johnson is a little bit surprising, but again, the idea that because he's going to be going out there and doing some bullpen work, it makes quite a bit of sense.
All right. Well, thanks so much. We really appreciate you joining us here today, Alex. For those of you out there, you can follow Alex on Twitter at Alex Spear. You can follow Matt Corey at MattyMatty2000. And you can follow myself at DevJake. If you enjoyed the podcast today, you can download us on iTunes or Stitcher, rate and review us there, and subscribe to the podcast if you like it. So again, Alex, Matt, thank you so much for joining us on this Labor Day and taking some time out of your busy schedule to come on and talk Sox with us.
Thanks for having me on. Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day, Alex. Thanks again.